It is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It's hard to be told that, you know, you're going to do this with 12 days notice and no advance warning it was coming. So the first thing is, I think he was sort of disappointed that he felt the need to not engage in a broader stakeholder process to let us know what his thinking was, because, you know, after all, we're the ones who have to implement this.
When we talk about the argument of the flu and all the past viruses we've had, because as Dr. Freeze said, mask saves lives and stops the virus. The polio, the smallpox, the measles, the typhoid, the HIV that was going to wipe our global destruction of human bodies with AIDS. We heard about that in the 80s, yet no masks were required.
The foundational premise of the sponsor's bill is that mask mandates are an example of government overreach. That is simply not the case. Mask mandates are a textbook example of the government ensuring one of its fundamental purposes, which is guarding the public health and safety.
Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats. Politics is a zero-sum game. And every extra vote they get through unlawful interpretations of Section 2 hurts us.
And with us to talk about Governor Ducey calling for schools to reopen to in-class learning, Arizona voting laws before the Supreme Court, and more, our former Corporation Commission Chair, Chris Mays. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
And Paul Bentz of High Ground. Paul, I have not checked Twitter. What are you wearing today?
Nothing. No, I'm just saying. I'm wearing a regular coat.
It's a daytime show, Paul. Come on now.
There's a visual. Paul. So
Chris and Paul, both of you have children, and I want to ask you about what you think about Governor Ducey issuing this mandate March 15th. There are some districts that were ready to go, they thought, soon after that. But Chris, let me start with you. What do you think about this mandate that a lot of districts, superintendents said they weren't really prepared for?
Yeah, I mean, let me say, you know, I think every parent in Arizona is ready for their kids to go back to school if we can get our schools ready for that. And certainly I'm so pleased that my daughter was able to go back 2 weeks ago. But, you know, the odd thing about this mandate by Governor Ducey is that it's a statewide mandate. I think it took a lot of school districts by surprise. A lot of schools had already made their plans for this semester, including doing some in-person, some online. And it's just odd for Governor Ducey to all of a sudden, you know, issue a statewide mandate to schools when, number one, clearly, he did not prepare the schools. He didn't fund the schools properly with PPE, with proper ventilation, helping schools with ventilation, with helping them set up additional social distancing through outdoor classrooms. You know, the state is still sitting on a $1 billion surplus, at least rainy day fund, not to mention the surplus. We didn't spend that to help schools open. And for a year, Governor Ducey and this Republican legislature said to the schools, oh, you're on your own, do your own thing, you make your own plans. But, and then didn't do anything for that year, sort of dithered in the meantime. And now we have this statewide mandate. So I think it's a little frustrating for teachers and for principals, but that's where we are right now.
Paul, let's start with what Chris had to say about the response from some schools and districts saying, well, this did sort of come out of nowhere. We don't know that for sure, but it did seem to feel that way to a lot of people. Start there for us.
Well, giving districts less than 2 weeks to change all of their plans seems a little difficult for some folks, especially if they weren't planning on opening. I think he could have clearly a while ago said, we're going to aim at the end of the third quarter, which is typically what spring break is the indication of. And you should have contingency plans or plans in place to start the fourth quarter in the classroom. That's what a lot of schools did. In fact, that's what my children's school did. Most of my kids have been back about 2 weeks now, preparing to making sure that they had the fourth quarter open. But overall, this is a pretty tough week for the governor with his credentials as the quote unquote education governor. Between giving schools less than 2 weeks to open and us finding out that his 20 by 2020 teacher funding plan is behind right now, it's a bit of a tough week for his education credibility.
Paul, I'm curious about the fact that it seems like state school superintendent Kathy Hoffman found out about this at the same time as the rest of us did. There's a lot made early on in the pandemic of the working relationship, the good working relationship between the governor and Superintendent Hoffman. Is that just totally gone at this point?
I definitely think it's strained at this point. And certainly this was more of a signal to conservatives at the legislature who are objecting to his executive order powers and less about his working relationship with Kathy. I think he wanted to take aim squarely at the AEA and the teachers union and make show them, you know, that he's in charge here. But springing it on everybody, I think, is sort of the most difficult way to do this. I think he could have built champions. I heard ASBA and others talking about this. Had he spoken to them beforehand instead of sort of surprising everyone 2 weeks before they're supposed to go back.
And Chris, you mentioned the timing a little bit, and I'm curious about the decision to bring schools back in person immediately after spring break, which is a time when people traditionally travel. And while certainly some of that might not be happening to the same extent this year as it normally would, for sure there will be some families that go somewhere away from home. There was some thought in some quarters, people saying, well, if you want to do this, why not, you know, have people come back, wait a week or two, you know, maybe 10 days to have people quarantine and then come back in person?
Yeah, and I think that would, seem to be the safest thing to do. Certainly, as Paul said, you know, you want to give schools the maximum amount of time, given what they're going through anyway, to get ready for this. You know, you have many schools are trying to do both online and in person already. It's incredibly logistically difficult thing to do. Then you throw in this issue regarding people traveling and, you know, what do we do when they come back? I will say, I guess, you know, the one thing that maybe Arizona is doing a little bit better than some of our surrounding states, and especially California, is we did start to get teachers vaccinated, I think, earlier than some other states to get them prepared and able to go back into the classroom. That is a good thing. But on balance, I think this is just a terrible performance by Governor Ducey on, you know, during the pandemic in general. But especially with regard to the schools, you know, I think you look at what a lot of private schools have been able to do in terms of you know, keeping their kids in school. Well, that's because they're spending a lot of money on things like PPE, on things like outdoor classrooms, and improving ventilation. And our public schools have been given virtually nothing in the form of additional funding to help them get through this. And let's remember, the pandemic isn't necessarily going to be over in the fall. We're hoping, obviously, that we get enough people vaccinated that people really do feel comfortable sending their kids back to school. But school, you know, schools are, you know, this is not going to be over for some time.
Paul, I want to come back to this idea of mandates, because when we thought about this, the idea that schools are mandated to open, there are still some people, some leaders, expressing disappointment that Governor Ducey never went ahead with a statewide mask mandate. Well, now we have this interesting debate, some would say interesting, going on in the legislature, and we played a clip of it at the top of the show. One representative who succeeded Jay Lawrence, who was also an interesting character to a lot of folks, said something on the floor that bothered a lot of people in comparing masks, how come masks weren't required with AIDS, for example, and some other things he listed, including polio. What do you think that does to the overall argument about mask mandates when it sounds like a rhetoric to some folks that makes, again, some people very uncomfortable?
I think that type of rhetoric is so far off the rails that it makes it very difficult to have a reasonable discussion about masks and what they do or do not, or acknowledging the fact that, for example, Arizona does not have a statewide mask mandate. There are some places that masks are in fact required, schools being one of them, restaurants and gyms being a couple of other places. But there's not been some oppressive level. In fact, it's been left to the local governments. There's one in place in Maricopa County and Pima County, as well as some cities. But I think overall, the governor's done a very good job of leaving it to the local areas. And then suddenly this comes along and starts saying businesses don't have to comply with that. That's, I think, the challenge here. That should be the subject of the debate, not whether or not AIDS was airborne, which is sort of where things have gone over the last couple of days, which is sort of a much tougher and much more difficult discussion to have.
Yeah, Chris, what does that do to the overall conversation when it sounds like someone doesn't exactly have a perspective on what the debate is, at least what some people would like to have the debate be?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'll be a little more blunt than Paul. It's a completely demolishes the credibility of the people who are saying those things, and certainly harms the ability of Republicans and the legislature to sort of claim any credibility on that issue. Obviously, it flies completely in the face of CDC guidelines and in the face of what the Biden administration is trying to get done in terms of continuing to encourage people to mask up. As we ramp up the vaccination process, it also, as Paul said, flies in the face of Governor Ducey's own policy, which is to allow cities and counties to make their own decisions. I disagree with that. I was, as you guys know, born and raised in Prescott, Arizona. Yavapai County does not have a mask mandate, and I think that has hurt us in terrible, terrible ways in Yavapai County and in Prescott. And has had devastating consequences for these areas of our state that have no mask mandates. So when you have a legislator saying, oh, let's just dispense with this for businesses, it'll be interesting to see what Governor Ducey has to say about that.
Paul, I want you to put your pollster hat on for just a moment, assuming you ever take it off. And I'm guessing you haven't necessarily asked this question, but do you have a sense of, let's say this bill does become law, like, are there a lot of businesses that are clamoring for this that would take down the signs that say you have to wear your mask in here?
I think, to Chris's point, in places in greater Arizona and throughout rural Arizona, this is a bigger deal. I was in Payson not too long ago, and I was wearing a mask into a store, and someone pulled me aside and said, hey, you don't have to wear a mask. And so I think that those sorts of examples, and not to mention, it just was announced that the mayor of Kingman is likely facing a recall election for keeping a mask mandate. So I think it's a bigger issue in rural Arizona, these types of personal freedom discussions and applying it to business. It's the same thing actually we saw back on the education thing, getting schools open, getting kids into the classroom, getting kids out from behind a computer, sort of this anti-COVID, anti the rules required with COVID, is a much bigger deal, we've seen in our polling, when it comes to greater Arizona and throughout the rural portions of the state.
Chris, would you say the same applies, at least in some respect, to some of the other efforts at the Capitol to, for example, reduce the governor's or eliminate the governor's emergency powers and end the current emergency?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, that is a very interesting phenomenon, and just shows, I think, how far to the right the Republican Party has gone, where you have them objecting to what I would call fairly weak executive orders, for the most part, by the governor on the pandemic, and in other areas where the legislature is sort of taking these extreme positions and now going after their own governor's ability to take action.
Paul, what do you make of those efforts? I mean, we've certainly known for a long time that some Republicans were not thrilled with the way the governor has used the emergency powers law, and now they're looking to change it and to end this current emergency. What do you make of those efforts?
Well, I think that's part of the reason why the governor called for schools to be open. I think that's why we did not have a statewide mandate, is I think he's been judicious in his use of the executive order in that way to try to give some flexibility and sort of avoid some of this discussion. It's come at him anyway. Maybe it's an effort to get the former Chamber of Commerce President Glenn Hammer to come back. His first job in Texas was to cheer Abbott for eliminating the mask mandate. So maybe they're trying to take it a step further to lure Glenn back to Arizona.
There's a theory.
Chris, go ahead. Yeah, right.
I was going to say, there's a theory.
Paul Bentz of High Ground and former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays. Chris, I am excited about the next one because I'm a political junkie. So Andy Biggs is floating the idea of running for U.S. Senate. And the way the Republican Party has become more conservative, it seems conservative in terms of, let's say, more to the right in the Trump years, there are some who think he actually could win a Republican U.S. Senate primary. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I totally agree that he could win a Republican primary. In fact, I think, and I'd love to get Paul's take on this too. I think if he were in a primary, he'd probably be the odds-on favorite. That being said, I think he's sort of the dream candidate of Mark Kelly. He and Paul Gosar would be the two guys they would want to see run and win that Republican primary.
Well, Chris, what are other names that come to mind for you? Not to put you on the spot.
Oh gosh, on the Republican side, I mean, I think Gosar, Biggs, who knows, which, perhaps a Republican legislator would want to hop in. It seems pretty clear at this point that Doug Ducey is not going to run for Senate against Mark Kelly. Looks like he's going to do his thing with the Republican Governors Association, maybe try to build up a national network of potential donors and maybe try to do something nationally in 2024. The problem for anybody who wants to run against Mark Kelly is, that is a very daunting task. They're going to have to be capable of matching his $101 million fundraising haul. So anybody who is going to take on Kelly literally is going to have to go from, if you're a member of Congress, raising hundreds of thousands or sort of, a few million dollars in a cycle to raising tens of millions of dollars. And I don't know if Andy Biggs can do that. Maybe he can, do that with sort of a national grassroots effort. Who knows, perhaps if Trump gets involved and helps him. But boy, I don't know. I think that's tough.
Well, Paul, I was going to say it might be hard for someone coming from the House to the Senate. And yet, other than Mark Kelly, if we look at the last few senators Arizona has had, Senators McCain, Flake, and Sinema all came from the House.
Sure. I think part of that has to do with the fact that once you've sent them to Washington, you kind of want them to stay there. So I think that's
part of it. So you don't have to see
them
in Arizona, you mean?
Right. So they don't come back, right? So, but I mean, I think part of that, the other name that should be mentioned is that Chairman Kelly Ward would be a probably the only more dream candidate than, say, Biggs or Gosar to run against. She'd probably have a few more statements on the record. Andy Biggs would be Mitch McConnell's nightmare in the Senate, bringing the Freedom Caucus over to the senior chamber, and rotting some challenges over there, I think. But I mean, Biggs would likely get Trump's support. He has a strong chance of winning the primary, but he's never stepped foot outside sort of the warm confines of a home game in a Republican-leaning district. I don't think he's ever really had a tough race throughout his career. This would be a tough race. He's never really been a prolific fundraiser, and Mark Kelly has presidential level fundraising numbers. Now, that being said, Mark Kelly does face some challenges of his own. He's got to define what it means to be an Arizona Democrat because, when you look at things like HR1, the immigration bill, the stimulus bill, minimum wage, all of these issues are going to be very difficult for him to navigate. And with only the narrow lead in the Senate, his vote is incredibly important. And he knows that he's only got 2 years to make an impact or to have all of these votes hung on him, and then that which could potentially make him vulnerable. So this is not a slam dunk for Kelly, but of the people who might challenge him, Biggs would be one they'd like to see because it's easier to sort of place Biggs in sort of that primary audience.
Well, Paul, is this the kind of situation where you might see someone like Mitch McConnell or someone like Doug Ducey try to shepherd somebody else into the race? For example, we've heard, for example, the name Kirk Adams, the governor's former chief of staff, former state House speaker. Could we see some efforts to, draft somebody else into the race that might be, at least on paper, more able to win a statewide general election?
I think that there's going to be efforts like that. And Kirk Adams has done a very good job to position himself as a conservative individual with ties to Ducey, who maybe hasn't gone over the line some of these other folks have. And so that's a good position to be in. The question comes down to is that the primary electorate within the Republican Party is incredibly small and much more conservative than even we can possibly believe. And they've never cared about somebody's electability. This notion that someone would be more electable in the general is not suddenly going to make them all change their mind. They're going to go for the one who they think is closest to Trump and the one who best reflects their most conservative values.
Chris, let's move to the U.S. Supreme Court. We heard they heard arguments, and we along heard arguments as well this week about a pair of Arizona election laws, one dealing with out-of-precinct voting, one dealing with the practice that critics refer to as ballot harvesting, otherwise known as ballot collecting. A lot of people have lost a lot of money trying to figure out and read the tea leaves of what Supreme Court justices are going to do. But based on what we heard earlier this week, do you have sort of a gut feeling on how these rulings might come, how this ruling might come out?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the oral argument in that case on those two Arizona voting restrictions. It certainly looked like the conservative majority on the Supreme Court is leaning in the direction of upholding the restrictions that you just mentioned, Mark, on ballot harvesting and the one having to do with having to strictly vote in your precinct. And it looks very much like it's going to be another hit against the and notch against the Voting Rights Act, and in particular the applicability of what's called Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Some of the arguments that came out that were made by those who were seeking to retain these restrictions, which are really designed the measures that the restrictions go against, you know, they're designed to protect or vote. At least Section 2 is designed to protect minorities and protect minority voters. But, for instance, the Republican Party lawyer made an extremely candid and open comment to the Supreme Court justices when she was asked, when the lawyer was asked, Why are you seeking to uphold these restrictions? And the lawyer said, well, look, we can't, basically it was, you know, we are at a competitive disadvantage when they're not in place. And, you know, read into that, the Republican Party apparently no longer thinks it can compete with minority voters, which is really sad. I'll say that as a former Republican, to hear a lawyer for the Republican Party just flat out admit that restricting voting is how they plan to win elections in the future. But long and short of it is, it looks like the Supreme Court's going to uphold those restrictions.
Paul, I'm not going to do what Mark did. I'm not going to ask you to place money or something, because we don't wager on the air, just so you know.
But, it's for entertainment purposes only.
Thank you, Mark. But I do want to ask you, when it comes down to what Mark Brnovich and the attorney for the Republican Party were arguing, how does that in some way set a tone for what we're seeing in the current legislative session? Some what people would call some voter restriction laws. We're seeing a lot of those attempted, at least in legislatures across the country. Is this part of the pattern we're going to see before 2022?
I definitely think we're going to see an ongoing pattern of various levels of aggressiveness to adjust or change the way voting is conducted. When it comes to the Supreme Court, I think it looks likely that they may uphold the ballot harvesting provision. In California, it is actually expressly legal, I believe. And here, I think what they're going to let states decide whether or not they allow it. I think it will kick off an effort throughout other conservative leaning states to ban it as well. It is something that is open to fraud, when you can go door to door and collect people's ballots. And quite frankly, some folks did this to themselves. There were people posing with pictures of stacks and stacks of ballots, trays of them, flashing them up like they were dollar bills and stuff. And I think that brought it to people's attention and made it a much bigger deal. When it comes to some of this electoral reform, I think some of them can be construed as thoughtful measures to protect the taxpayers, but then other ones are just out and out efforts to restrict people's rights to vote. When it comes to technology, I think things like these precinct changes, you know, when you can generate an individual's ballot at any given precinct from any place, it seems sort of that we should move that way to allow more people to vote and make it easier to vote, not more difficult. It's the same thing with early voting. Arizona's been on the leading edge of early voting, and we shouldn't be taking steps to make it more difficult. We, in fact, the rest of the country should be sort of following our lead when it comes to how successful we've been with implementing it throughout the state.
Guys, in the last couple minutes of conversation, Chris, I want to have you jump in on this one. Paul, obviously, want your perspective as well. There has been some discussion of the legislature, some advancement of proposed legislation related to the Corporation Commission and what power the commission should have. Chris, I think we know what perspective you're going to have as former chair of the commission, but what do you think of the legislature taking this kind of action to, in essence, take power away from another elected body? To some, not to stretch too much, to some it reminds, is reminiscent of what's going on with the state senate versus the Maricopa County supervisors, this feeling of an overreach, in essence. What do you make of that initially, just in terms of someone who was on that board before, on that panel?
Yeah, Steve, it's just so sad to see this happen. And what basically what the legislature is trying to do with Senate Bill 1175 is completely undermine the clean energy rules that the Corporation Commission is in the process of passing. Some very terrific clean energy rules would take Arizona to 100% carbon-free energy by 2050, would have some ambitious but very doable energy efficiency requirements, allow the commission to do energy planning, which they have done traditionally over the years. And it's completely unconstitutional what the legislature wants to do. And it would upend basically 110 years of Arizona history. And it's just bizarre to see the legislature do this. It also flies in the face of what major corporations that we want to move to Arizona want to see happen. Companies like Microsoft and Google and REI and American Express and, you know, major semiconductor companies, manufacturers want to be able to source their energy from clean sources. And this bill would actually prevent that from happening. And so I certainly hope the legislature doesn't pass this and the governor vetoes it if it does pass.
Paul, very, very quickly, I want to ask you about the controversy, which we've talked about a lot, about the ballots from Maricopa County going to the Senate. Seems like we don't really know where they're supposed to be right now. And I've seen the analogy of this is sort of a dog catches car situation where the dog chases the car and then it reaches it and doesn't know what to do next. What do you make of all this?
It reminds me of The Dark Knight when the Joker says, "I'm a dog chasing a car. I don't know what I'd do if I actually caught it." I think, you know, what we're looking at here is I think we'll see soon enough. And I thought Secretary Hobbs's letter to them encouraging them to have processes in place and sort of setting some rules of engagement out for the Senate was a wise move on her part. I'm not sure what's going to happen next. I hope as a voter that they protect the chain of custody of my ballot. It is my secret ballot. And that's part of what the rules were in place for to begin with. And I hope they take that that charge very seriously.
Yeah, I'll have to jump in there. That is Paul Bentz of High Ground, former Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays. Great to talk with you both, as always, and stay well.
Thank you.
Thanks, you too.